It's looking relatively stable. Housing permits are down a little bit this year. We think there's a little bit of a reporting issue, so I won't go into that too much. We're trying to figure out sort of where that is. You might have read a couple of, maybe last week, we have the second lowest office vacancy rate in the country. So the office market here is very tight. The only market that's tighter is probably our apartment market, our multifamily market, where we've stayed below 3% for a couple years now.
Josh, let me interrupt you for just a second. Yeah. I've been remiss in not introducing Frieda Christopher, who's here as an alternate for Katie Larcell this morning. So some of you know Frieda, some of you don't, but we wanted to make sure that she got introduced and to your fellow volunteer advisors and obviously to the staff who will be making the presentations this morning. So it's nice to have you here. Please.
Thanks. As we move to the next slide, just a broad look at the employment growth, what you'll notice is that employment growth is basically as good as it gets, we think, right about now. What we're seeing is commensurate with what we've seen in past expansions, especially given the maturity of our economy, local economy here. We think this is basically as good as it's going to get. We might be able to sustain it for another year or two, but we don't expect us to pick up any more growth, any more speed. I should note, too, the growth has been a little different over this expansion than in prior ones. A lot of what we talk about when we talk about the job growth that we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years is really what we're calling job polarization. We've got a lot of high-end jobs and a lot of low-end jobs, but there's not a lot in the middle. And that's sustained itself for the last few years, and that's still what we're seeing today. We've got high-end professional business services with high incomes, relatively stable jobs, and we've got a lot of low-end retail and tourism. And so that's sort of a mixed bag in terms of how good it looks.
Does employment growth just measure full-time employment?
It's total jobs. This is total jobs. So when we look at hours worked, that's increased quite a bit. So if you look broadly, but that doesn't mean that there still aren't a lot of people working multiple part-time jobs or that would rather have one full-time job. That's still happening, particularly at the lower end. If we look at the next slide at how we compare to other cities, you know, we're in good company. We're right next to Seattle and San Francisco, wedged right in between in terms of how good we're looking. You know, this is not atypical. During expansions, we do better than average. During recessions, we do worse than average. It says a lot about our employment base. We're a little more manufacturing heavy, although that's changing. But this is not atypical. If we look at the next slide, declines in unemployment rate. You'll notice it's a kind of a weird hodgepodge of cities at the high end. This is a decline in unemployment. So we've seen unemployment fall from about 11% in the city down to 4.5%. And when we talk about unemployment, we're talking about residents. So they may work out in Hillsborough or Beaverton or Vancouver, but the residents of Portland have a very low unemployment rate. It speaks to our cost of living. As it gets higher, it's harder to live here without gainful employment or dual income employment. But this chart, you can see, you can be on the sort of the good side of this chart for a couple of different reasons. Detroit has seen the biggest drop in unemployment rate from 26% to 13%, still higher than we were. And most of that is because they've lost more than a third of their workforce. So it can be a little bit of a mixed bag. Let's see here. One particular note, tourism is incredibly strong right now in this area. We're seeing massive increases in our transient lodging receipts, both because of higher occupancy and because now we can charge a higher rate. We're still cheaper than most cities on the West Coast, so there's still room to grow. But the industry has taken notice, and according to the consultants that we work with, we've got about 2,400 new rooms in the pipeline just in the city center alone, which would be about an increase of about 30% in the available hotel rooms in the city. So we're seeing a lot of growth in that area. As we move to the next slide, we talk about inflation. Inflation has been extremely low, especially around the country, but also locally. And this is driven a lot by energy prices. So it's not as big a concern as it might be otherwise, but it is very, very low. And it's something that will impact our budget, maybe to the positive. If you're looking at the city as a whole, if you're a city employee, not as positive, because you're looking at a pretty low COLA probably for next year. And we'll be pushing that sort of collective bargaining limit of 1%, is my guess. I want to talk a little bit as we look at the next one, that we do have some issues in the city. The issue of the day is housing. I think we can take a moment to recognize that part of the housing problem, a lot of the housing problem, has been brought on by good things, things that cities want. We're importing highly educated workers with good incomes, and that are young families and young couples, and so we're seeing some income growth because of that, and we're importing some wealth as well from California. I'll talk about that a little bit more in just a second. So that's part of the reason why all these trend data look good next to other cities. And so while all of these things are looking good, there's a more than sneaking suspicion that part of the reason they look good is through displacement. We're importing a bunch of higher income, higher wealth individuals and pushing some people to the city boundary and beyond. And so as a result, in aggregate, the city looks wealthier. But it's part of that is a different demographic. As we look at the housing market as a whole, this slide was put on here mostly just to show we've got record low inventory and record high prices. So expect the prices to continue to go up. I know in inner northeast Portland, there are massive investor groups shotgunning proposals to households to see if they're willing to sell. And when you get that kind of institutional capital into the market, you change the market dynamics and make it more attractive for people to take the money and run. But if you have to buy in the same market, you're kind of out of luck. And so we've seen a lot of influence of that lately. Let's see. Something else that came out of the last recession that we're seeing sustained is that Portland's got a lot more renters than it used to have. Probably for a variety of reasons, some of which are demographic, some other reasons are financial, certainly. But this change from about 42% to about 49% is the equivalent of between 15 and 20,000 households. So that's part of the reason why you're seeing massive multifamily growth and multifamily construction, is that we've got a change in the dynamics of the consumer, the housing consumer. And so that seems to persist for now, and I don't expect it to change. I know Metro doesn't expect it to change. That seems to be a character going forward of the city is going to be much more multifamily.
So is that because the construction in multifamily that's happening is rental? I mean, is it a chicken and egg thing? Which comes first? Are there no people can't afford to buy condos, so they're having to rent? Or what do you think is happening?
I think that's more likely the case than the other way around. Part of it is demographics. So it's older people retiring and downsizing, and they may or may get a condo. They may rent. But there's a lot more multifamily housing demand on that end. Also, the type of individuals and young couples that we're bringing in have high student loans that prevent them from buying houses. Sometimes they are taking. It looks like a Portland discount to come here a little bit from the Bay Area. So I think it's a little bit more from that side than the construction.
Josh?
Yeah.
As an economist, do you have any concerns about a city where almost 50% of the residents are renters?
It's a good question. I don't know. I haven't looked at other cities to know what that dynamic looks like in other comparable cities. So I it's something to look at. I'm not sure that I have any massive concern on its face. We do know that, at least historically in Portland, we've had a lot of long-term renters. So, you know, it's not as transient a population as I think a lot of people envision or a lot of people experienced when they were renting before they bought their house. People are delaying buying houses a lot longer. So they tend to stay in place a little bit longer too. But we'll see.
And do we have any data about how that splits across different socioeconomic groups? I'm worried that we may have some of our more vulnerable population that is now locked out of home ownership.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the case. I mean, the reality is, and especially if we see any rise in interest rates. I mean, interest rates are still low. That's pricing a lot more people into the market. It's also helping feed this investor frenzy, too, that are pushing up prices. But when you can make back your money in you know, 10 or 12 years renting a house, if you're an investor and you're putting money in, and you know, it makes more sense, especially with low interest rates, to go that way. And I think we're definitely seeing that. And certainly the renters are more vulnerable to the higher rents being pushed up. We're reading that in the paper. They've got stories. And with the investors come these sort of mass renewals and rebuilding of individual buildings that cause some displacement. As I mentioned, incomes are rising, and we're looking better, and we're rising pretty significantly relative to other cities, you know. And again, we're in good company next to Boston and San Jose, and we're, you know, not far from Seattle and San Francisco. So we're becoming more and more wealthy. Again, some of this is probably due to displacement. We have a different population than we did 4 years ago, and that's changing probably even more rapidly. But the reality is that the incomes citywide are getting better, but they're not rising as fast as rents. So if we look, and this speaks a little bit to Chris, to your question, is what we're seeing is that this is the change in the proportion of renters spending at least 30% of their income on rent. And you can see that in a lot of cities that's gone down. More people have gotten jobs, they have higher incomes, rents have stabilized, and those kinds of things. And we're seeing the opposite here. So they're just not growing quite as fast.
Josh,
yeah.
Looking at this, because there are so many cities sort of on the right side of this, but I have to assume their rents are also going up. Is it the case that their incomes are going up faster than their rents, which is causing that to drop below the 30%?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's definitely what's happening. And their job growth is maybe less polarized. You might see higher-end job growth, too, that are influencing those rents. So... this is kind of a tongue-in-cheek, but the reality is that we're getting a lot of migration. And this is statewide. These are licenses surrendered to the DMV. We had to use a statewide number because you can do it at any DMV. It doesn't have to be location-specific. But it turns out about a quarter of them are from California, and about 20% are from Washington. We spent a little bit of time, and we'll put some stuff out probably later this winter, about IRS migration data, which I think is a little more telling because we can get that down to the county level. And so what we can see is X number of filers filed in whatever state or county in 1 year, and then the next year they filed in Multnomah County. And we can see how much income is being effectively brought in versus the income that's going out. People that weren't filed in Multnomah County and then went... And then the next year they filed outside of Multnomah County. And so we'll get a little bit more dynamics about what that in-migration pool looks like. The problem is that it's IRS data. It's delayed a couple of years. So I'm really curious to get sort of the next batch in the next couple of months, and we'll see what we can glean out of that. So why are we getting a lot of Californians and a lot of people generally is we're still relatively inexpensive. People who want to move out west, we're still cheaper than just about every California city, with the exception of Sacramento. And even rents are cheaper still. And so, you know, while we've got these issues, as has been mentioned prior, so does most of the West Coast. There's a housing affordability issue up and down the West Coast. And so for people and young people in particular that want to move out west, we're still an attractive market to come here. For companies down in California that want to move here, we're attractive as well. I was at the Oregon Economic Forum a couple weeks ago, and the editor of the Portland Business Journal mentioned a company out of San Jose that decided to move up here in the spring, and they offered all their employees, if you want to come, you guys can come, we'll set up shop in Portland. Every single employee came. So it speaks a little bit to the livability, but the affordability as well relative to the Silicon Valley.
So Josh, could you, it's hard to put all this together when you have separate pages. We're relatively inexpensive, incomes are rising, but we have more renters. Can you put that in a broad picture for me as to why all of this is occurring?
Sorry, we've got a little bit of a housing supply issue. That's part of the reason why you're seeing all the building that you're seeing. It takes a little bit of a housing supply issue. That's why you're seeing all the building you're seeing. It takes a while to react. We had a lot of pent-up demand, too. You know, it's a funny story, but it's a true story that we had during the recession. We had a lot of kids in the parents' basements that are now have jobs and are moving out. So you've got those people in addition to the typical group that would that come every year. So the market took a while to react to that because rents had to get high enough to make the capitalization on the markets work.
So with the low interest rates and the rising incomes, I would have expected to see more people buying and the number of renters going down, but we see it going up. Is that due to a change in people's philosophy on owning? Is it a lot of people coming in and renting in the short term, a year or 2 years before they buy? Do you have any sense of that?
It's two things primarily. One is demographics, as I mentioned before, sort of older people downsizing, and there's some renting in there, and younger people coming here. It's harder to buy a house when you've got a lot of student loans, and that's happening there. The other thing is this investor class that's come in. I think that's been a big influence where they can bid up and pay cash for a house. It's appealing to sellers. That turns into a rental house almost immediately, pretty much, and stays that way for a while. So that investor class and again, these people, it's still cheaper than Seattle. It's still cheaper than doing this in other parts of the West Coast. And there's a desirable market, and they're seeing rents rise. And so I think that influx of money into the market makes it more difficult for buyers to.
So I have a house next door to me where a California investor bought it, and I now have 8 20-somethings living in that house. is that
a zoning violation?
You should sell your house to that investor.
Huh? Well, I'm waiting for that call. Yeah. Is that where we want to be as an economist again? I don't know if that's good or bad. I know what I think next door, but I don't know about a city's profile, whether that's good or bad.
I don't think it's sustainable, which is why I think it's probably bad. I don't think that this is investment money that chases the next dollar. And so at some point, the next dollar won't be here. And so to the extent that triggers sort of people getting out of the market in mass quantities, it's not just you and me selling, it's somebody selling 8 homes in an area that they've bought and were an investor and now they're getting it out, you know, or they're selling 2 now and 2 the next year and 2 the next, you know, there. So that the exit strategy out of this, I think, is harder.
Josh, on the rental side, is that a mix of studio, one bedroom, two bedroom, that sort of thing? Or?
Yes, it's everything. It's just we can break it out a little bit further, but that's what it is.
Okay, there could be different mixes in different cities, but
no, I think absolutely. There's different mixes in different cities. There's also a changing mix in Portland. You know, the luxury market in Portland is the one that's really really booming right now. And so so it's where developers can make the most money. So that's where the first dollar is going to go until that market's satiated, and then they'll go down the chain.
Thank you.
Josh, looking at the cities where rents are not going up as fast as ours or rents are staying closer to the increases in income, would it be possible to look and see whether public policy is influencing that, looking city by city? Like some people would say that you can keep rents down by having inclusionary zoning. Some would say that you keep rents down simply by having rent control. Some people would say you keep rents down simply by allowing more building. So is it possible to look at some of these cities and determine whether it's, you know, the differences between them and us is independent of those factors, or there is some argument that those factors matter, and if so, which matter more or less?
Yes, is a short answer. We haven't done a comprehensive look at it. I started a little bit because it's my world, looking at economics papers and trying to see if public policy has worked in certain areas for affordable housing. But you bring up another point. We can look at comparable cities a little bit more, too. And so the housing stock will drive what's comparable. So we'll spend a little bit of time. We can look at that.
Well, you know, I want to just note something back to Donald's question. We have been we still want to be a middle-class homeowning city, right? We want to accommodate people who want to rent instead of own a home, and we want to have a variety of housing types, and we want all those things. But we have prided ourselves and still hope we are a middle-class homeowning city. And we've talked a lot on the housing side about that issue, and we need to. But we just touched on something very briefly in the economic indicators that's worth going back to. And look at that, those columns of indicators. There's a lot of concern about keeping and adding so-called middle-wage jobs, manufacturing in particular. And the one economic indicator on that list that is spectacularly negative is Port of Portland marine freight. And that's not because we're shipping less wheat. It's because we don't have a container port anymore. And the public policy failure that is the most egregious one in terms of our economic future is the failure to resolve this issue about how we once again become a container port. And I talk to small manufacturers every week who are talking about how it's costing them $500 more a container to get whatever they make here or whatever they're shipping here to make things in from the Port of Seattle or somewhere else. So if we want to look at the big picture of the complexion of our economy and whether we have people living down the street that make something and therefore can afford their house payments even though their property taxes have gone up, it's imperiled by the fact that we were a port city for all types of freight, and now we're only a commodity port. That's a big deal.
Josh, can I follow up on something that Steve asked? When we look at the rising rents and we're looking at the kind of rental housing that is being fueled right now, with a lot of out-of-state money coming in here chasing pretty significant returns, you end up often hearing the same debate recycled. On the one side, you have people who say that, who blame government and say that with the urban growth boundary and with the regulatory cost that we impose, it's no wonder that you know, house rental costs are going up, because we've in a sense artificially created scarcity through the urban growth boundary, and regulatory costs of course have to be passed on to the consumer, the argument goes. The other side that you hear is that we're in this unique moment where capital is chasing high returns in rental investments. We lie between two cities that have higher cost structures, and so it was inevitable that capital was going to find us and come in and say we can boost prices and make some money. So as between the heavy hand of government argument and market forces largely beyond our control, where do you come down as on the question of what's been the most significant factor driving the rising costs and rents?
That feels like a loaded question, and maybe my answer would be self-serving. But I think over the long term, the first is a big influence. So the urban growth boundary, not within the city of Portland, it's not influencing the city of Portland. We're talking about on the whole metro area wide. Absolutely, there's more density than there would otherwise be. You just have to go to a lot of other cities in the country, especially in the Midwest, and you can take an hour and a half to drive through Houston at 60 miles an hour. It just keeps sprawling out. And so metro area-wide. In the short term, I think it's much more the latter. We're seeing them chasing, large investors chasing returns, but they're chasing it. I don't know that it was inevitable. That's the one thing I would say. The reason they're chasing returns is because Portland's been a good place to live. It's a better place than it was 30 years ago, and the reality is it's much more comparable to Seattle and San Francisco as from a quality of life standpoint than it probably used to be. The other thing that you'll see is not unlike how parts of Portland are different than they were 30 years ago, and you've seen returns being chased in some of those areas. And so I think in the short term, it's much more the investor-fueled looking for a return. In the long term, it's much more of a concern about regulatory practices and increasing costs on the front end. Okay, I'm going to wrap up here pretty quick. So just some other indicators, you can read them. Just some interesting tidbits that when we grab the data, you know, not wholly unexpected. You know, like mentioned, we're getting a lot of young couples, married or unmarried. A lot of people need roommates to afford where to live. We have the fourth highest proportion of households that live with non-relatives. You know, we've got a lot of self-employment. That highlights two things. One, it's a creative economy. Two, it's an economy that people want to live in. So those people that have choices about where to live, this is one of the places they choose. And we're a high-tech city, getting more high-tech by the day, as I read. So we got a very high end of broadband. That speaks to the newness of Portland as well, relative to the other cities around the country. Just a thing that economists love to pound home: education is the biggest long-term driver of capital accumulation, of income drivers, of all these things. We are now the ninth, I believe, highest concentration of percentage of the population with a bachelor's degree. But we were the second fastest growing over the last 5 years, so we're climbing up that list. Again, just another piece of evidence about where we are and the type of individuals that we're importing.
And I was going to say, Josh, because am I right, though, that the local numbers of students getting bachelor's degrees are lower than this total? So this is actually reflective of that displacement.
Absolutely.
Dynamic you've been talking about. These are people, a lot of these people are moving here with their bachelor's degrees.
Absolutely. Finally, just the things, just to summarize, you know, the dynamics are changing pretty rapidly. I think that's part of the driver of the urgency that we're seeing and the nervousness. The city's been changing for a long time. We've been moving in this direction for a while, with a few hiccups because of the recession, those other things. We've been moving in this direction a while, but it's really picked up in the last 12, 18 months. And so it's the rapidness with which we're seeing these changes occurring that I think is driving a lot of the uneasiness. Again, housing is taking off. Housing is also, like politics, location, location, location. So there's a portion of the city that's doing a lot better than another portion of the city. And again, we've got very, very low inflation, although we're seeing some medical inflation picking up a little bit in the near term. I don't know that that's going to be sustained, but that's sort of the picture as we see it right now. Happy to answer any more questions, or we can...
Josh, if I could say...
Sorry. I was admonished by Chris Smith recently, who watched a work session, and Chris, get a life, on TV. And he said that when we didn't push the button, he couldn't hear it, and there was no text. So anything you had to say actually went into the ether. So he admonished me that we have to talk with the button on.
And I wouldn't want to be in your category, so. So just for him. I'm reading a lot of... being retired, I read a lot of economic and financial magazines. It's pretty exciting, and I'm reading more and more about some economists who are predicting a recession within the next 24 months. I don't know if that's true or not, and who knows. First of all, I'd like to know where you stand on that. Second of all, if it ends up being true, then a lot of things concern me about the city because we tend to suffer more during whether it's hiring new employees for the city or the house next door going unrented and going into disrepair, et cetera, et cetera. What's your feeling about that?
I should preface it by saying the joke is that economists have called 9 of the last 2 recessions. So there's a lot of there's always going to be people on that side of the spectrum. I would say that the growth that we're seeing right now does make me a little nervous. We're sort of building up the cliff. It's not going to be a cliff, but building up the mountain. So we're making it a little higher. It's a little easier. So we have the potential to fall further. That having been said, I don't see it in the next 24 months. We are 6.5 years into this economic expansion. So we're getting to the point where we're going to get a little bit nervous. We'll talk a little bit more during the budget session when we look forward about sort of how it works internally within the city and how that dynamic might be more of a problem. But no, I think in the short term in particular, but even the medium term, we're probably not too susceptible to it. And I don't think there's a recency bias too. I don't think the next recession is going to look like the last one, especially in terms of depth. We don't have the same overhang of investments and sort of internal financial works.
Yeah. Josh, I have a big picture question about housing affordability. That actually, there's something I've been saying that I kind of assume is obvious, but I should check with an actual economist. It seems to me that the rapid increase in housing prices here, which is outstripping rising incomes for most people here, is in large part a reflection of the widespread economic inequality we have in the country, where Portland is an attractive city to a lot of people, including rich people. So rich people are moving here. But if the rich people weren't so much richer than everybody else, then their ability to bid up prices far beyond the scope of most people would be more limited. I mean, do you think that it would be accurate to say that if we had a more equal distribution of wealth and income in the country, then it would be less likely that you have housing prices soaring out of reach of average Portlanders?
Yeah, I think there's a couple aspects to that. But broadly, absolutely, that's correct. The other one part of having this investor sort of driven housing market or parts of the housing market is that they can pay cash. They can come in. I mean, it's a different sort of transaction. And so even if another buyer can afford a home under our traditional home buying system, they get priced out just on the structure. The other thing that I would say is that part of what you're seeing is really a inside of 82nd phenomenon in a lot of ways, which speaks a little bit to the dynamic that we can't look at housing in a vacuum. We have to look at it in terms of housing and transportation costs, because I think a lot of people are making that calculus, which is why you're seeing a couple big buildings going up on the east side of the Burnside Bridge, all that stuff on Division, even the Pearl. It becomes a desire. When people make the calculus of, well, I don't need a car if I live here, then that changes the whole cost dynamic too. So we can't kind of look at housing just in a vacuum.
The institutional investors are buying because they think there'll be enough people with money to rent the places they're buying.
Sure, absolutely.
I think this is anecdotal from what I've heard from people in the real estate world. I think those institutional investors, however, are concentrating on low to mid-price housing, not the highest-price housing, which exacerbates the problem. Because if working people are struggling to be able to buy a house, they're being outbid. Not people in the most expensive neighborhoods. I think that's what's going on.
No, that's absolutely true, and that should have been part of what I was saying. Is that that's what's happening? Is that even people who would buy a starter home or buy, even probably a little bit above a starter home for some people, they can qualify for the mortgage. It's not a problem. They've got close to a significant down payment. They're getting priced out because of the transaction's more appealing for the seller. I've gotten letters in my house, no transaction costs. We'll do cash, kind of thing. And if you're going to sell your house, that if you don't have to pay transaction costs and you don't have to go through a broker.
Josh's excellent presentation, as always. I think I'd just put a footnote in, maybe for the next time we do this, one more indicator that I think it would be useful for us to track. It's more of a social indicator, not an economic one, but I think it feeds into some of the questions about what's happening to us socially and economically, and that would be what's happening to enrollment in the public school districts in the city. It's going up, but how much and compared to before? And I think it would be useful to see that, because that gets to the question of, who's buying those houses, who's renting those units, are they staying in the city or are they planning to? It just seems to me that if we look at school district enrollment, it will help us see a little more clearly that bigger picture. Other questions for Josh before we move on into performance management? So, great. Thank you very much. Well done. Thanks
Josh. So now we're going to, again, move into performance management. We're going to talk a little bit about sort of what is currently happening in this world with the dashboards, and then how we're going to be integrating the performance data into your budget decision-making process as we go into this into the 16-17 budget process. Shannon Carney is here to walk us through that, our performance management analyst.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. Try to make sure I've pressed the button here. So, like Andrew said, I'm Shannon Carney, and I'm the performance management analyst for the City Budget Office. Is this on? Okay, good. So I feel like one thing I should get out of the way right away is that I am a renter, so full disclosure. Hopefully that's proof that we're not all bad. But here we go. So I do want to talk about performance management today. So a couple things I want to highlight is just that there's a lot of performance happening around the country, and Portland is a part of that. So Josh has shown us how Portland stacks up against comparable cities, and I think we stack up well in terms of our performance management efforts as well. Second is just pivoting to how we can use performance data as we go through the budget process this year and beyond. So feel free to jump in with questions. I know it's an exciting topic. So performance management. Performance is definitely trending, and the City of Portland is part of that. So, you know, as a brief stint of history, I'm sure you all recall that it was just 2 years ago that we started working on priority setting and determined the priorities of complete neighborhoods, housing and homelessness, and emergency preparedness, and have been tracking and reporting on those priorities. Last year, we adopted our key performance measures across all the bureaus, and those are the measures that that represent the outcomes of our bureau's core programs and services. This year, we're going to be looking at setting targets, both fiscal year and strategic targets, to make that reporting system even more useful. So these actions have definitely established us as a leader amongst cities in the country. We're by no means the only city that has a performance dashboard that we're regularly updating. Cities like LA, Houston, Atlanta, Boston, Seattle, there were others, but I won't list them all, are doing this as well. So what's driving the interest in performance dashboards? And excuse me for the pun there. So I would say the greater availability of data. So we all know that there's more data available to us all the time. We have a choice of either being bogged down by that data or using it to our advantage to be able to make better budget decisions or better policy decisions. There's an increased, I would say, public awareness of open data sources. I think the vendor payment system that we launched, that the city launched in June, is just one example of that, how people can use the scale of government data to make their own discoveries and to hold government accountable. And of course, thankfully, with all this data, there have been some amazing advances in technology to be able to manage and visualize the information that we have. So here at the Budget Office, we're using Tableau software. There's lots of other software applications that help us take what used to just be presented in a spreadsheet or numbers, which isn't very visually appealing, and put that into a visualization that people can actually interact with.
So I'm going to take the opportunity to plug a comp plan policy that will be before you, which is an open data policy that would encourage the city to make the raw data behind these performance indicators available to the community so the community can crunch them and reach their own insights and do innovative things with them. So.
Yes, and that's a big advantage for us. So what are some real recent milestones for the city? So obviously there's a lot going on about around performance management. One of the big things that we did earlier this year with launch of the mayor's performance dashboards, and this is if you haven't been to the mayor's performance dashboards, I have to give a plug for this. It pulls together a number of measures across our city's most important priorities, puts them together with regional metrics to give a more complete picture of how we're doing as a city. And those were updated earlier this summer. We representatives from the city actually got together with some people from Multnomah County, and we gave a pretty well-attended presentation, I have to say, for a lunch hour in mid-July. Might have been on a Friday. We actually got a large number of people from the city together to listen and hear about how we're using data visualization techniques to work with complex data sets. So we did that earlier this summer. City Budget Office worked with TriMet to give a presentation at the Tax Supervising and Conservation Committee. And, of course, the vendor payment checkbook, as I mentioned. Budget maps, so that's something that we're continuing to update. And those, just as a reminder, show how we've spent our capital and operating budgets, as well as our level of service for some of our city's biggest bureaus. Something to look forward to is we're actually going to pull all the budget maps together into a visualization so you can scroll through and see how things have changed over the years and also how things compare amongst bureaus. So stay tuned for that.
I'd be really interested in having a full presentation on that specific topic.
Great. Make a note of that. So that's kind of what's happening, just citywide milestones, but there's essentially a performance wave, I would say, happening both in the city and through our regional partners. So two of the squares here kind of show what TriMet and Multnomah County are doing. Some really impressive stuff. TriMet actually has a dashboard that they update monthly with some of their more important metrics. And Multnomah County's auditor's office actually presents some of their reports through data visualization. So this is the pay equity report that got quite a bit of press. And then, of course, you know, there's a lot happening in the bureaus. So it's not just citywide. And these are just two of the bureaus. I don't want to leave anybody out. But Portland Parks and Recreation has been doing a lot of performance, incorporating performance data for quite a few years now into their comprehensive annual report and using it for internal management. And then we've all seen the Portland Bureau of Transportation Vision Zero crash map, which is updated daily. So pretty impressive stuff. So I think this begs the question. All this data at our fingertips, how can we use this data to inform budget decisions moving forward? And hopefully this circle here will give us a little bit of a clue. So I just wanted to talk about where we are in the performance and budget cycle. I'm sure you're all very familiar with the outside of the circle, which shows the steps in the budget cycle. So right now we're at the full blown, for example. I want to talk a little bit about what we have on the inside of the circle, which is what we call the performance cycle, and how these steps complement the steps in the budget cycle. So, like I said, right now, you know, we're here at the fall bump. This is also the time when bureaus report their performance data to the budget office. The next step for that, after the bump is over, a city budget office analyst will actually use this information, analyze it, and present it to you in the prior year report. So that's when we evaluate bureau performance for the past year. That information can be used to, as you work on your requested budget decision packages and assess budget decisions in 16-17. Steps after that, we continue with performance reporting. Bureaus actually have an opportunity to update their performance projections with the spring budget monitoring process, and that's also, again, a point where city budget office analysts will be using performance data to help us write reviews and make recommendations in the spring bump. Finally, we'll actually be adopting both fiscal year and strategic targets for our key performance measures with the adopted budget. I won't go around the circle again. I don't want to cause any dizziness. So, yes. So given all that, you know, so we have quite a bit of information to share with you, and we wanted to just talk, you know, give some examples of how that might be used to assess the results of our major investments over the last few years. So these will look pretty familiar. We've had some significant investments in transportation. Clearly, some dollars towards the parks replacement through the bond. Our major maintenance policy has helped us invest quite a bit of funding towards those infrastructure projects. And then, of course, housing is a potential investment for this year's fall bump. So this is meant to be a little bit of a look back, but also a look forward. So when you're thinking about these major investments, we can actually use these key performance measures that we already are reporting on to see how the investments are working, you know, if we can see those impacts. For example, you know, in terms of parks, two key performance measures that are highly relevant are the Parks Facility Condition Index listed there. So we'd expect to see that continue to rise in 15-16. And then, of course, the percentage of residents that are rating the overall quality of our parks and recreation facilities as good or very good. And so that's information that comes from the Auditor's Community Survey. So ideally, we'd like to see that rise as well. So those are just two examples, and there's others listed on our performance dashboards. So next slide. So again, looking forward, So
I just want to interrupt a minute, because I'm not sure we would see the parks facilities continue to rise. It depends on whether the amount of money we have is greater than the deterioration, and I'm not sure that it is. I think it merely fixes the worst, it patches the worst holes, but I don't know that it gets us ahead of the game.
Okay.
The condition index is supposed to capture?
Right, but I don't know whether we would expect it to continue to rise as a result of the parks bond, because if we still don't have enough to keep up.
Right.
So that we'd need to have a further analysis of, you know, where are we at on that spectrum.
People understand that,
yeah.
Sure.
So even if it went down, that wouldn't necessarily mean that the parks bond was a bad thing.
Right.
Because it might have gone down even worse.
Yeah, that's right. And I think as we talk about this data, I mean, the more robust this system is, the more fine-tuned we can be in terms of measuring that. It would, had we sort of had, again, that fine-tuning, maybe you were already seeing a decline of a certain rate, and you could see then the parks replacement bond slowing that decline. So it may not raise it, but it would hopefully still be having that positive impact. And I think that's what we're trying to get at, is that we can actually show what that impact is and make sure that it's achieving what we expected it to achieve.
So looking forward, we have some upcoming budget issues that are on the table. So things like housing investments, you know, potentially background investigators, some issues around parks, firefighters. So we can think about how to use our existing key performance measures to evaluate, you know, where to put these investments and what kinds of outcomes we're trying to see. So there's some examples right here of the housing measures that we have right now. Housing units open, and these are off of the Housing Bureau's dashboard. So housing units open that are newly affordable, and then percentage of households that have moved from homelessness into housing. It's kind of a recidivism, capturing recidivism. And then retention rates of households that are placed in permanent housing in 12 months. So I wanted to, so this is going to be a little bit harder for council to see, but I did want to take this opportunity to navigate to our performance dashboards and see if I can, just to show you, it's a little bit more exciting than just looking on a slide. But these are actually live right now. So we've been working hard to update our online dashboards with the prior year actuals, so our results from fiscal year 14-15. So this is right off of the portlandoregon.gov/CBO website on the performance tab. And what you'll see is this wheel with the different bureaus logos, and you can click on I'm going to click on Housing Bureau since that's sort of what I was talking about. So you can actually click here, and that'll pull up the Housing Bureau's dashboard. And that's the case with all the other bureaus. So you can either do a sort of assess at a glance and see how things are going, look through, see what the key performance measures are. Those are what are listed on the rows. And then this gives you a brief glance at comparing historically, so fiscal year 12-13, up through the goals that we have for this coming year. And then these trend arrows actually indicate they indicate the trend that we're seeing from the 13-14 actuals to the 14-15 actuals. So the last 2 years of actuals that we have indicating that trend. So if you click here, this is the fun part, then you can actually, it's a couple layers here, but you can just look at the bureau that you're interested in and, again, view those measures. And then when you click on each one of the measures, this is kind of fun. It gets beyond just seeing the percentages or numbers and actually visualizes the information. So we'll see if it happens. Anyway.
Is this all available at the CBO webpage?
Exactly, yeah. So this is portlandoregon.gov/CBO. Might be having a little bit of a Wi-Fi issue here, but if you can... I can leave it up there for a second. But basically the idea is that it pulls up the key performance measure and actually shows the visualization of that. And it distinguishes between the actuals that we have, so seeing the trends from 12-13, 13-14, and so forth, and then distinguishes those from the targets that the bureaus have set for that key performance measure.
And Shannon, there are some additional drill downs on some of those as well, right? Some pop-up screens that sort of give a little bit more explanation about the measures.
Exactly.
Some of those.
So if you're looking for more information, you can hover over. So if you hover over the trend line here, It'll give you a little bit of information about, you know, how the comparison and how that's trending. This question mark here gives a little bit more information. You can actually download how to interpret the performance. So that's the one pager that you saw last year during the work sessions. That shows how to actually interpret those measures. And then you can even download the data sources and the KPM methodology appendix if you want even more information. So we've actually seen some pretty good download data from just the people looking for the underlying data set beneath the measures. That's kind of exciting to see. So where do we take all of this? I think it's a pretty exciting time to be able to utilize performance information. And there's a few things that we're hoping that that you'll get involved with over the course of this year. The first is that City Budget Office is going to be working with bureaus to establish targets, both fiscal year targets, which we already have for our key performance measures, but refining those and identifying if those are the right targets. But we also want to work with bureaus to set strategic targets. So what are the aspirational goals? What do we really want to see out of this, out of these policies? And that's where we can pull in things like the Portland Plan and the other strategic initiatives that we have as a city and bring those into our performance management system. So secondly, we're hoping that that you use this data to inform decisions. So performance management isn't always a happy story. Sometimes there's lagging outcomes or there's results that we're not hoping to see. So using that information to understand if there's a need to change an approach in a bureau or maybe a need to redirect resources, maybe it's a matter of coordinating and problem solving across bureaus. And finally, hoping that we can use performance data together to communicate outcomes. So as I said initially, you know, this is something that a lot of the cities that we compare to are doing now. I'm really trying to change the conversation from how much we're spending on different programs and services to what we're trying to get out of those for everyone that lives, works, and plays here in Portland. So thank you.
Thanks, Shannon. Thank you.
Shannon and Andrew, I applaud your work in managing data. There's been an explosion of data in our society, and I'm not sure it's brought greater clarity on anything. So how we harvest data and how we communicate data is very important. But let me pose a challenge and just get your feedback. We have worked collectively to come up with some dashboards and some indicators. And the question that I often have is, are those indicators relevant to the people we serve? So I'll give you an example. There are two dashboards in utilities that I lead that are pretty meaningful. One is, do we continue to have a AAA credit rating? And the second is, are our response times under 2 minutes? So we've decided collectively these are very important. I have never had a citizen ever raise either issue with me. Instead, what I hear from, in terms of people who are measuring my performance, our collective performance, what I hear is, are rates going up? Will I be paying more? And that's a fair question. I mean, that's as real as it gets. Well, you know, are you raising rates, and will it impact my bottom line? So, I guess the question I have: how do we ensure that this laudable exercise in creating benchmarks and dashboards and managing data is actually relevant to the people we serve? And how do we make what is the mechanism to tie it dynamically to what people actually care about? Because I fear that with this explosion in data in our society generally and the ease of access to the internet, that we're potentially overwhelming people with data and information, but I don't know that it necessarily is leading to greater clarity of purpose in terms of how we govern or how we make decisions. And just wanted your reaction to that.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really excellent point. And I think the performance measures that we're tracking need to both be tracking what's important from a city operations standpoint, but also tracking what's important to citizens. And I haven't looked at those two. I try and look at all the dashboards every day, but I haven't looked at the water and BS. But I'm pretty sure that at least one of those bureaus actually does have an affordability measure that they're tracking in terms of how much that bill is. But I'm not sure that both of them do. But I think that that's really what we're looking for from you all is that feedback. What are the things that you're hearing that we should be tracking so that you have a data point to go back to? So when you get that call that says, you know, my utility bill is too expensive, you can point back and say, well, let's, you know, or you can point someone to the dashboard and says, you know, this is what's happening. This is what has happened over the last few years, and this is what our target is in the future. So at least the conversation is not, it's specific around what's happening.
Yeah, and I guess the ongoing challenge is for most of the people we serve, their view of the data is normally part of a narrative and a set of stories. So for example, I've been watching Commissioner Novick closely and studying his every move. And I realize now that if I put resilience into the same sentence with any budget ask, it gets a greater positive reaction than if I don't. So almost everything we're going to be presenting to council this fall is part of a overall resiliency plan. But seriously, I agree with something you said earlier that very much, which is at the end of the day, people don't look at the data points necessarily in the abstract. They want to know, are they getting good value? And so one of our challenges is how do we tell that story that what we are delivering to the public gives good value? And so in the utilities, we say high quality, reliable, right? We talk about those values, and then we say, and at a fair price. You can make your judgment. But the people aren't going to make their judgment about price by looking at comparative data in every city in the country or going to, you know, logarithms. They're going to say, am I getting high quality, reliable, safe water? And if so, yeah, I'm willing to pay for it as long as it remains that way. So I just and I actually think that some of the dashboard stuff that's evolved over time has become more useful. But I would just challenge us to always go back to this question. Is it a data point that resonates with us, or is it a data point and a benchmark that resonates with the people we serve? And if there's a delta, how do we close that delta? Because ultimately, we want people to see these benchmarks and say, I have confidence in my government or not. And less so, I think, just aggregation of lots of interesting data. Because frankly, I think I'm fairly typical in this regard. I feel overwhelmed by data. In fact, I data is no longer really my friend because there's so much of it, it's a full-time job just to manage it. I'm looking for clarity. And data hasn't brought us more enlightenment in government. Data hasn't brought us more, you know, collegial behavior in the Congress. Data is just overwhelming people. So how do we make sure our data is relevant to the people we serve?
Well, I think those are really good questions, and we're all trying to feel through that, you know, that passageway between where people used to know more than they apparently know now about what their government's doing. One thing we can all do, which we may already be doing well or we can improve on, and that is if our front desk folks in each of our offices, if the staffs in our offices who are responding to citizen questions, if folks at the INR information referral line are sending people to these dashboards saying, you really want to know what's going on in the Water Bureau, check out this site. You know, I think that will allow us to get more feedback about whether people, citizens, are finding this useful or not. So we can probably all up our game in terms of sending people to this resource, and then we'll hear, I bet, at least anecdotally, about whether people, do they find it useful? Is it giving them clarity? Is it credible to them? So I think we ought to carry on and intensify that that connection effort to connect people to this resource and then evaluate how well it's working.
Yeah, I think those are great points too. And I especially agree with that, you know, we want these measures to resonate with the public and that we're looking to your feedback to make sure that we have that right mix of high level outcome measures that make sense for the bureaus, but also that are simple enough and interesting enough to the public that it's something that people will pay attention to and use. I would say that, you know, I've been here about a year and a half, but City of Portland is definitely a complex organization. So I think, you know, we can't get away from having to use data and information and complex data at that and having to still that to be able to manage our operations better. So
just on that point, I had lunch last week with a good friend, longtime supporter, We've had many conversations about government. This person's never shy about offering me critical advice. And about somewhere in the middle of the meal, he turned to me and said, "Now, would you remind me, do you work for the county or the city?" And, you know, one of the things that keeps us humble in these jobs is that the people, many of the people we serve have very busy lives, and our day-to-day work is not directly on their radar, struggling to survive.